Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle. Hello and welcome to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor. As always, I'm joined by my two fabulous co-hosts, Kate Bakos and Peter Kalizos. How are you today, Pete?
I'm very good indeed, thanks, Dave. Had a great weekend. I did a field trip with my past and present students. A bit different.
Oh, yes.
Normally the field trips are about comparable sales and looking at properties with development potential, but this one was a money-making trip, so outside of uni. So we looked at...
How much were you charging your students?
No, mate. It was just $60 to cover the bus.
It wasn't money-making for you.
No, it wasn't. Just very satisfying that I know that... I mean, it's one thing to teach the students about, you know, how to get a job in property and what they need to know, but I was also keen to teach them about, you know, how to make money in property.
Yeah.
So we looked at, you know, what makes a good investment property, what doesn't, and we looked at profitable development sites rather than just sites with development. So that was very, very enjoyable.
Yeah, great. I'm sure they got a lot out of it.
Yeah.
That sounds so cool. Way different to my field trip on the weekend.
Yeah, what did you do, Kate?
I didn't really get a weekend, and I know that sounds like a first world problem, but I try really hard to get a Sunday, and there's just a lot happening at the moment, and there's a little bit of frantic agent and vendor behaviour going on as well. If a vendor gets an offer that's pretty reasonable, they will want to wrap up the sale. They don't want to wait around, and understandable. You know, it's a bit of a nervy climate right now. So I was working right through. So Friday afternoon, I didn't really get off. And Sunday I was seeing property and analysing. So my field trip, you know, wasn't coordinated like yours was, Pete, and it wasn't as fun.
Well, we had functions on Friday and Saturday night, which is very rare when you've got three young children.
Oh, you sound like Ian. Stop it.
So we're still catching up on sleep, I think, after two reasonably late nights and then, as always, early starts. On Saturday and Sunday mornings with kids' sports. So we
recovered. That last tequila, it's always a good idea until the next morning.
Last whiskey sour. Today's episode, it's actually from a listener question and really basically asked four questions and wanted to know about the various types of sales methods and the reasons why each are adopted. And I'll go through his four questions soon. But before we get into that, there is so much happening in the markets across the world.
Before we get into today's episode, take a listen to our weekly market update.
Pete, have you got a market update?
Yeah, look, mine's very quick. Heard on the news today that Dominic...
Okay, that was one of my second ones. So perfect.
Okay, you've got one each.
Let's go. I've only got one now.
So ahead of the New South Wales state budget, they're going to introduce an annual land tax instead of stamp duty, which is going to be very interesting. I've actually done a little video for the Property Investment Professionals of Australia on the advantages and disadvantages of stamp duty versus land tax. I'm not saying one's better than the other. It's happening in Canberra, but Canberra's only got a few hundred thousand people and, you know, maybe only just over 100,000 dwellings. So it'll be interesting to see how it works in Sydney, where they have like millions of dwellings.
Yeah, well, it's a crack in the dam wall, but the cracks are getting bigger and it's going to crack open at some point in the coming years, that transition, I think. But this one is just for first-time buyers.
Right.
So they can opt for land tax, an annual property tax payment of $400 plus 0.3% of the land value.
Interesting.
So you can buy up to $1.5 million worth of property.
Yeah.
And normally, like I'm just doing the numbers in my head, normally the land tax would be like, the stamp duty would be like $60,000.
Yeah.
They've only got to pay $400 a year.
plus 0.3% of the land value. So if you're buying a property for 1.5, let's say it's the land's worth 1 million.
Yeah.
So you've then got $3,000 of land tax plus the 400. So you're paying $3,400 versus, let's call it $60,000.
Okay, $3,400 per year whilst you own that property.
So it's a I think definitely first home buyers are going to opt for the land tax.
I agree. Yeah, I think that's an excellent move too. Yeah. Get into the market.
Now the strange thing is, if they then sell it and on sell it to someone who isn't a first time buyer, it goes back to being stamp duty. So they've just put a little, just dipping the toe or the foot in the water, mm-hmm. and they want the feds to come in and provide some money. So I don't think they've gone as hard as they would have liked to, but Dominic Perrottet definitely wanted to do something.
That'll be an interesting one to watch, really. Yeah. Well. Let's see how the blend of first home buyers versus all buyers changes in New South Wales.
It's going to protect price falls somewhat as well, because it will bring first home buyers back into the market.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, in New South Wales. Thanks for your market update, Pete. That's great.
Which was part of yours.
That's just yours. Kate, what's your market update?
Well, it wasn't hinging on that, but it's a related topic. And my market update is my observation at the coalface with the different categories of buyers and their attitude towards what the market's doing now. And let's be clear about what it must feel like to be a first home buyer. You've got the media throwing headlines that are scary at you every minute of the day, and one person mentions a 30% price decline and all of a sudden it's gospel. They would be justifiably feeling really anxious about doing anything. And the reality is that I've seen a segmentation of the market, anyone who's never experienced a rate increase versus those that have been through it. And we talked about this last week, but it really is a very distinct difference in terms of buyer behaviour. Mm. I'm dealing with anyone who's sort of my vintage or older saying, let's buy. We had a strategy, let's roll it out. And I'm dealing with everyone who hasn't experienced a rate increase or anyone who's been in the market only for the last 10 or 11 years, they're jittery.
Yeah.
And so when we look at the types of properties, the stock that is suited to those jittery buyers, that's the stock that's offering a bit of opportunistic buying at the moment.
Mm.
And I had one that was, we should have paid more than what we paid for it. I don't want to name the address or the agent because he's awesome. He did what he could with one buyer in the ring.
Yeah.
And this typically would have been a property that had loads of people fighting over it and putting their hands up. And in fact, the identical property next door sold for $2,000 less than the price I negotiated 4 and a bit years ago.
Well done. Mm. Good buy.
Well, taking heed of the opportunity, but I had a nervous buyer at my end who I had to talk to about all of the risks, all of the mitigants, all of the what ifs, and then point out that these buying conditions were enabling her to get something that was a very high quality property, ticking every box for a really good price without competition.
And was that buyer a home buyer or an investor? And
first home buyer.
First home buyer who's willing to take the plunge. Yeah.
She was pretty nervous, but she did it.
Yeah, so there's opportunities out there for those who are willing to take the step.
Absolutely.
Very good. I don't think we can go by without mentioning what's happening in the crypto world and
collapsing in front of our eyes.
No punchline yet.
And the share market. So, you know, we've talked about at times over the last 6 to 12 months, I've said at times that, you know, increasing inflation would put pressure on rates going up, which then would put pressure on the share market and cryptos and then the property market as well. But so what we've seen, you know, certainly in the crypto space, well, firstly, the US Fed increased rates on the 15th of June by 75 basis points, which is the highest rate hike in 28 years. So they started talking tough only a week or so prior to that move, and that's spooked the share market, but also the cryptos, which for a long period of time, a lot of people were saying was a hedge against inflation and also against the share market, but it's proved not to be. It basically moves in tandem with the share market and worse in terms of what's happened. So it did have a high of $66,000, Bitcoin did. It's now sitting around $20,000. That's a 70% fall. Now, what we're also seeing is some crypto exchanges have ceased the ability for people to access their funds and make redemptions. that's a sure sign of a market in free fall and where there's real panic, you know, not allowing people to take their own money out because it could collapse.
That's like banks freezing accounts.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Mm. Yeah. I think the crypto world is going to implode in the not too distant future.
Well, I agree, Pete. I definitely agree.
And I hope my son is listening, because my son and my young nephew, who obviously won't listen to wise old people, I will invest in some crypto. Just invest as much as you want to lose, mate.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they're doing now.
Yeah. We're going to upset a few people potentially with this. I mean, it's clear the three of us are not interested in investing in crypto. I looked up what Warren Buffett thought about crypto. He has a famous quote. It's like rat poison squared.
Yeah, well, Bill Gates has been an avid non-believer in Bitcoin for some time, and he's recently restated that he believes it's 100% based on the greater fool theory. And
well, like a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, basically. And, you know, reading about the most predominant market is young males who own crypto.
Well, I just said my son and my nephew. There you go.
This is a really hard one, because I don't ever have a problem with saying what I think and why. But the reality is I haven't invested any mental energy in understanding crypto. And I know a lot of people that have made some serious money out of trading in it. And it's fair to say that when we talk about making money in property, we're not traders. We're long-term buy and holds.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a key differential in our time frame and our approach to investing anyway. But it would only be fair to say that this is just our opinion on something that we haven't really investigated a lot. And I wouldn't like to upset any of our listeners by being dismissive of crypto. But for the three of us, it's fair to say we see a lot of risk. And unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of downside currently. I just hope that our listeners who have invested in crypto or are invested are insulated and feeling okay about where they're at.
Well, I think if you look at the utility of digital currencies, you know, it's ultimately, there will be a transition to digital currencies.
Yeah.
But they'll probably be run by governments.
Correct.
And then there's definitely a utility in the technology of blockchain. Some cryptos may last the test of time. But here's an interesting fact that many of our listeners won't know, okay? So there's 180 what's called fiat currencies in the world, about 180. There's over 19,000 crypto coins now. Now, if we've got by with 180 currencies, I don't think we need 19,180 currencies. So just the being fortunate enough to pick one of the currencies that's actually going to last the test of time out of over 19,000 is a big risk in itself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, before you even look at the reasons you invest in it. So I think, I don't know how many of our listeners would have been aware of that. So anyway, I'll move on. US share market's fallen by more than 20%. The Aussies beyond 10% falls. So the potential upside for these falls for those who own property is that it may mean that less work is needed to be done in raising rates to curb inflation, as this wealth destruction will already be impacting many from spending as much as they had been. And it's also a good example of why share markets and now cryptos tend to be more volatile than the property market, because they're able to react right away to changing sentiment, whereas, as we know, the property market takes many months to transact, buy and sell property. And at times, the primary period of fear has passed before the property market has fully had time to caught on. And that's part of the reason why the Aussie property market, it's not the only one, has never dropped by more than 10% across the board. So just rounding it back and connecting, having a bit of a property connection at the end of those facts.
Nicely said.
All right. Well, that's a pretty lengthy market update for us this morning.
It's time for gold nuggets now, wouldn't it, Dave?
Time for gold nuggets. A few gold nuggets in there, I reckon, Pete.
I think there is.
We love hearing from our listeners and we'd love to tackle more of your questions. So please, if you have any on your mind, no matter how great or small, send us a message. You can email us info@propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor, or go to our website, Facebook page, or simply click on the link in your podcast app under the play button and fill out our online form.
We had this question from Nicholas. So and this is today's episode. So, hi, guys. Thank you for such an informative but entertaining podcast. I've just listened to the episode on off markets, and I'm just wondering if you can offer some insights into, here, there's four questions. How to navigate when a property is on market, but it is listed as EOI, which stands for expression of interest, rather than a price range. Why might a vendor do this? Do you put your best price forward and declare all your cards, or is there still an opportunity to negotiate? Is it a case of Pete's rotten apples potentially? Thanks, team. Warm regards, Nicholas. So great questions, Nicholas. Thanks very much. I think a lot of people buying property can relate entirely to those set of questions. So we thought we'd dedicate an episode to them. How about we start, Kate? What are the typical methods of sale around our nation?
We've got a few ways that we do this, but it's generally three groups. Well, private sales, first and foremost, which is where they're either stating a price, a set price, or a range, or there's no price tag, but it's for sale. So we know it's not an auction or an expression of interest. If you pay the right price, the vendor's happy, they'll sell it. The next one is a sale by tender or an expression of interest or set sale. They've got a few different names, and this is what Nicholas was referring to. And that is often an agent tactic for various reasons, not just one reason. So it might be a bag of rotten apples, but it might actually be the most amazing gem, but it's such an unusual gem, no one knows how to price it. So let's leave it to the market. And sometimes it's just one of those properties that is so rare and so appealing to someone who may be considered wealthy. Put the expression of interest out there. We have to remember the agent is working for the vendor. So they'll pick the process that's most likely to get the highest price and a reasonably fast result. And the next one is an auction, as we all know. So they're the three main ones that everyone hears about. Then the two that I always get asked about are off markets and pre-markets. Mm. And so we want to chat about all of these today, but shed light on why agents pick varying types of sales campaigns, when they can change how to play them, how not to get caught out by them, and just to understand why. You know, what is it? What's the main reason for the vendor, and what does the buyer have to be aware of?
Yeah, great summary, Kate. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Pete?
No, Kate's our buying expert here, so she's going to have all the inside knowledge. I just wanted to give my opinion. I don't like buying at auctions. My preferred method of purchase is private treating, mainly because I have time on my side. You know, here's my offer. If you don't like it, that's okay. I might come back tomorrow with another one, or next week, or I might not. That's very hard to do in the hot market. I mean, the market is certainly cooling now, not so much in Adelaide, but around the rest of the country it is. As a seller, right, if I've got a unique property, definitely I'm going by auction, or if the market is really, really hot, like it has been the last 12 months, expressions of interest. And generally I have found, certainly in Adelaide, that you know, stuff was sold within 7 days. Mm. First open, multiple offers, sell it during the week.
You've still got the heftiest auction clearance rate across the nation.
Yeah, the highest one.
I saw that. You're still sitting in the 80s. What on earth is going on?
Well, we went, as part of the property tour that I mentioned before, we went to two of them, and there was 30 of us, but there was about 40 other people there at one auction in Theberton, inner city suburb of Theberton, that sold for a record price in Theberton. And then we went to another one in Keswick, which is another inner city suburb, post-war home development site. Not as many people, but still sold. Mm. So stuff is still selling even in this market.
Yeah. And the reality is Melbourne's the auction capital of the country. Sydney, in a strong market, has many more auctions, but generally it's not as high as Melbourne. And the rest of the capital cities don't really have a lot of auctions. So you can get by with buying in other capital cities without dealing with an auction other than pretty much Melbourne and Sydney. But if you want to buy well in Melbourne, you have to be willing to purchase at auction. And I think one of the reasons, you know, Melbourne and Victoria, or particularly Melbourne, is so strong in auctions is because you can buy conditionally. And so there's actually a motivation for agents to take properties to auction, because then it's sold no matter what. And, you know, people can't condition the sale and then delay the sale. Whereas in somewhere like New South Wales, you can be gazumped. So if someone comes in with a higher and better offer, that then can be taken, whereas it can't be in Victoria if you've agreed to the price, even with conditions on there. So I think that's part of why the history has occurred of Melbourne being the auction capital of the country, which isn't often talked about. So what factors make these types of sale methods vary, would you say, Kate?
Well, often it's the type of property, the calibre of the property, the type of audience that are likely to pay attention to the property and the type of bidders or purchasers that you're likely to be dealing with. But it's also seasonal. It's also based on the city itself and, and what takes place in that city or town.
Yeah.
And lastly, it's the market sentiment. You know, if you're in a seller's market, you'll treat it quite differently to if you're in a buyer's market.
Mm.
So there are quite a few factors. But when it comes to expressions of interest, you wouldn't place an expressions of interest campaign on something that's a dime a dozen and super affordable. You generally work with something that's really unique, that has a chance of getting a stellar offer that really surprises everyone. Generally speaking, a vendor that goes to market with expressions of interest is really hoping for a happy surprise, like a really massive happy surprise. Every now and then, though, it might be in a country town, it's not a high turnover market, it's an unusual dwelling or shop, that might just sit on the market casually with expressions of interest because they'd like to get a sale and they don't want to scare anyone away with a price tag. But that's very rare.
Yeah. And so with the expression of interest, what happens for the vendor, for our listeners, if they get the highest offer is really low and much lower than they were hoping for?
Okay, well, this sometimes does happen and we see campaigns change. You see auction campaigns change when the property passes in, it goes to private sale. Sometimes you'll see an expression of interest with a, they're usually accompanied by a deadline. So you, the agent doesn't want to just leave it floating out there. They'll give everyone about a month, similar time frame to an auction. And if they get underwhelming offers, they might convert to a private sale or they might convert to an auction.
Yeah.
Converting to an auction in a down market would not necessarily be a great move, but it depends on what sort of interest they've had. Because the idea of an expressions of interest is to create scarcity and competition and have someone place an offer that they are confident will be substantially over other offers. Now, agents love to have a wide berth between the first and the second offer. The buyer wants to have a dollar between the first and the second offer. You know, no buyer wants to win something by an enormous margin and no underbidder wants to lose it by a tiny margin. It is a way of selling that makes buyers very, very nervous. And sometimes you'll miss out on good buyer participation for exactly the reason that Nicholas stated, is something wrong with it. Another one that he touched on was, do you show all of your cards or do you put a little baby step forward first? Now, that comes down to your agent communication. And you'd be surprised to hear this, but agents will sometimes say best and highest, one crack, one offer, closed envelope. We're all opening them with the vendor at 5 o'clock on Friday. And then they ring you and they say, is it really your best? And you're like, well, you've got in bold, underlined 50 font saying, give us your best offer and it's your final opportunity. Yes, it's my best. Oh, well, you know, I'm just giving you the heads up. It's really close between you and someone else. I can't tell you the exact thing. So this is the kind of stuff that does go on. And if I was to imagine a percentage chance of this happening, it's greater than 50%. So when I've submitted my best and highest, I've usually got that phone call. Now, sometimes they're fishing for a little bit more to look like a hero. Other times they're being honest. Kate, we don't want to let you down. You're a fraction under someone else. And sometimes they're looking to create competition. I've had situations where they've then called me back and said, okay, there's three of you still. You're all really close. So tomorrow night we're having a boardroom auction. So you do get hybrids.
Yeah.
And while it might annoy you, there's no rules around this. It's the agent's rules. They make up the rules. They're not always bad rules. And as long as they're transparent, you know what's going on. But it can make it very difficult. What it does say, though, is when buyers say it's my best and my highest, it's often not the case. Sometimes there is a little bit more. And social proof might be what's required to get a higher offer.
So therefore, with expression of interest, and obviously every case is different, how badly do you want the property and how much competition do you feel like there is and, you know, what's the stage of the market cycle?
But
there's no, I mean, you at times won't necessarily put in your best offer.
That will come down to my relationship and my negotiations and discussions with the agent.
Yeah.
if I don't know the agent very well and they stare me down and say, it's closed envelope, Kate, best and highest, I'm giving them my best. If they're likely to say, well, give us something good and we'll call you back, that means I'll get tipped off or I'll get another opportunity. If they say, oh, look, we'll get everyone's best, but we'll go back to the top three and then we'll talk to them all, that also has me playing a different set of cards. It's got to come from the agent. I need to know when they're wrapping it up, who's making the decision, is the vendor there at 5 o'clock, or is the agent just collecting all of the offers at 5 o'clock and then we find out on Sunday afternoon? Possibly.
So it sounds like the buyer needs to clarify.
Absolutely.
In advance, yeah, yeah, whether it actually is best and final or yeah, or whether there will be room to move
yeah,
after, even though it says best and final on the piece of paper flyer they've been sending right around for the
expressions. Sometimes agents
interest
say to me, look, we'll be transparent. Mm. We'll call you back. We'll give you an opportunity, but we won't tell you anyone's offer. Well, mm, that's not transparent. But anyway, we'll deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can get hints. And if you're nice to the agent, as in respectful and prompt with your communication, it's unlikely that they'll burn you. You just need to be really clear on whether you're getting that phone call with an opportunity to change your offer. Sometimes they'll say to me, look, I won't tell you the other offers, but if you've been beaten, if your offer has a higher offer on the table than yours, we'll come back to you and give you an opportunity to increase. Well, it just depends on the agent. Sometimes they'll give me so many hints, I know exactly where I need to be. Other times you make an educated decision. Is this worth another $5,000?
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au. Have you ever been part of an expressions of interest process, Pete?
Yeah, and generally I'll put in my highest and best offer.
Yeah.
And when they come back to me, and generally I wouldn't desperately want it because it's only an investment property rather than a home,
mm,
I'd say, no, mate, that's my highest and best offer. And if I miss out, that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There'll be another one.
I remember once, ages ago, I had a difficult agent and I was not getting any hints or help. And so I said, I will beat your highest offer by $5,000 for any unconditional offer. Because I didn't want to be played and, you know, have some 190-day settlement with a subject to finance clause for 180 days. I didn't want to be pitched against that. And at the time, that was a bit of a bullish thing to do on my part, but that was my own purchase.
That's a very good strategy, Kate.
Unless someone's got mega bucks, Pete. No, I cut you off. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I was just saying, you know, having said that, you know, that's my highest and best offer and no more. I haven't bought anything for the last 2.5 years because, you know, generally I've been outbid. But also I haven't been going that hard in buying because I'm at a stage of my property investment timeline where I don't need to buy any more long-term investment properties. I would like to buy some development sites, but they've also been very hard to find. But, I mean, times will change. You know, as we've talked about many times in this show, the market goes in cycles. You know, the last 18 months or so, it's really been a seller's market, but that'll slowly turn.
Well, look, I think that's answered most of Nicholas's questions there, Kate. You've shared some great information around in and around other types of buying. Is there anything else you'd like to share before
we? Great for all of the listeners who are thinking of selling or any current vendors and anyone who's interested in how you look at this from the other side of the coin when you're about to sell. I had one little question for you to pop out there. Why wouldn't you auction a property? And the same can be said for an expression of interest. It's a very similar technique. You're creating scarcity and fear, except one is driven by social proof and the other one is only driven by fear and how hard you imagine someone could stretch. And also, you know, what sort of guidance and rationale should you be looking for with your agent when you're considering the various methods of selling? How do people make decisions about stepping forward with a particular campaign? And I think, Pete, you've got license to talk about this completely because you've been a seller in recent years.
All right. So we're talking from the vendor's perspective here.
I mean, because I know a little bit about property, I have some idea how it should sell. Like Kate was saying, I don't have any. But if I had a flat in a group of 20, I wouldn't be taking that to auction. But if I had a property on the Esplanade then I probably would be taking that to auction because they're scarcity value.
And what about if your flat in the group of 20 was ground floor with courtyard on title, completely renovated, plans and permits all sorted out with courtyard and doors opening out onto it, like an apartment you cannot easily find?
In Adelaide, probably not. In Melbourne, probably yes.
Yeah.
Because as Dave said before, Melbourne is the auction capital of Australia, whereas here, except for the last 18 months to 2 years, it would be very rare that an apartment or a flat or a unit would go to auction. Very rare. But the last 18 months, either everything went to auction or everything went by expression of interest, or it was going to auction and it sold before auction. That's how hot the market was here and also around the country. One thing that's apparent in South Australia, I don't know how apparent it is in interstate, some real estate agencies are very focused on auction. They'll take almost anything to auction. So when it comes time to selecting your real estate agent, you need to be careful of what is their preferred method of sale. Is it auction, no matter what the property, or maybe at the other extreme, they never take it to auction and it's always private treating. So you need to do some research yourself on the type of property you have, what you think is the best method of sale, and also do some research on the real estate agency that's going to sell it. What is their preferred method of sale?
Yeah, it should be part of the interviewing process.
Yeah.
Understand what they think you should use in terms of the method of sale and why.
And why, very importantly, and why.
Yeah. And have your own perspective. I mean, I might be oversimplifying it, but ultimately I think one of the key reasons to go to auction is if you think you have multiple buyers who are keen for the property. And so therefore you're going to create that competition through bidding that is going to continue to push the price up through that process. Whereas if you are worried you might only have one or two or not a buyer at all potentially, or if you're not that certain, then there's much greater risk in taking it to auction.
Yeah, agreed.
Was there anything else you wanted to cover, Kate?
Oh, I could talk all day about this. Yeah, like all right. Day. Oh, one little itty bitty thing. Sometimes we see price guides in certain cities and states. There's a couple of states. Well, we know that Queensland don't have price guides for auction campaigns. But if the price guide changes for your expression of interest or your auction, if it gets reduced, what does that mean? And if it gets increased, what does that mean? Now, these days, we're seeing a few more reductions than increases. Last year, we watched what we call step quoting happening a little bit, which is where it's pitched at a particular range to attract a certain number of people and maybe they've overshot it. You know, they've overshot the runway and they've got 100 people at the door. There was one, I think I mentioned it when I was having a rant a while ago, quoted 8 to 880, I assessed it at 1.25 to 1.3, it sold for 1.35. And the agent kept saying to me, oh, you know, we've had hundreds of groups through. Yeah, no doubt, of course you have. Everyone will line up for a bargain. So price guides can be moved, sometimes because the agent is honestly quoting where they think it sits based on buyer feedback. But we all know agents should have a sharper idea of value than buyers. But sometimes there's a property that attracts more people than they imagine for whatever reason. If we see the price guide being shifted down, it doesn't mean that you can buy it for that price. It means that they want to get more people through the door.
Yep, that's a good little example to finish with. And also the best buyers will understand price guides as well, if not better than the agents. And that's what you should be striving for as a buyer, to know the market that well, and that's where you're able to buy with confidence.
Yeah.
I think that's answered Nicholas's questions really well, guys. Thank you very much for those questions, Nicholas. Hopefully they'll help you on your path to buying successfully, and I look forward to hearing your gold nuggets, Kate and Pete. If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
My gold nugget relates to people who have that feeling of trepidation when they see EOI or set sale or sale by tender, because they can panic, you know, what do we pay? How do we buy this successfully without having a crazy winning margin between us and the underbidder? But how do we not miss it? And it's always that fear and greed having a really difficult grapple at the time of being under pressure to put your offer in it on a certain day, a certain time. So what I say to people is do your research. Just as you were saying, Dave, knowledge is power. If you've done your comparable sales analysis and you've got a very good idea of where this sits, you're really well equipped. Now, often these are very rare properties, and that's when trouble can strike for a buyer, because how do you put value on something so scarce? You've really got to ask yourself a couple of questions. How important is it for me to have this scarce product? You know, if it's the perfect property for you and you've been looking for a year, it's very important. Or if it's a shop front or a facility that you really need. And they're the buyers that I say, you need to be prepared to pay a premium, because what you're looking for is so rare and this is ticking all of the boxes. Now, before you go and do that and put extra on the pile, you need to be really certain that you can cover all of that. Your finance covers it. You've got buffers in case the bank doesn't agree with the price that you've paid. I mean, these are some of the risks that are scary for buyers, because if you beat someone by $50,000 on an $800,000 property, that's a wide margin. Could you have an issue with the bank? So you've got to go through all of those things, but knowledge is power. And if in doubt, you can always talk to a friendly opposition agent to help you out. You'll be surprised how many people will be forthcoming with a bit of advice when you ask nicely.
Yeah, that's a really good example, Kate. And unique properties, they're much harder to value. So, you know, if you're looking to purchase a unique property, it obviously makes more sense when it's a lifestyle purchase or something you're going to use for your own business, as the example you provided there. And then you need to put an emotional premium around that, and what are you willing to pay for whatever are the unique aspects of that property that entices you to it. But if you're an investor, maybe you need to think a bit more rigorously around whether you should be going for it and maybe be a bit more conservative with your price offers.
Yeah, I'd be very, very shocked if an investor was going for an EOI unless it was maybe a commercial deal. EOIs are typically really sought after, really rare and slightly quirky properties.
So mine is based on auction. So when you go to an auction, if you've come up with a round number, let's say you reckon it's worth $1 million, I would encourage you to not stop at that round number and maybe go $1,005,000 or $1,010,000 or $1,015,000, because that million is also a psychological barrier to people. Like going from $995,000 to $1 million seems a lot harder than going from $1 million to $1,005,000. So I would not be leaving your final bid at a big round number like that, but also have a number in mind, and that's where you stop. Especially if it's an investment property, that's where you stop, because auctions are based on a number of things, including emotions. You can get caught up in what's happening and you think, oh, what's another 5,000, another 20,000, and then before you know it, you're paying far too much than you wanted. Have that number written down, and that's where you're going to stop.
That's awesome advice, Pete. If you go through the sold tab and have a look at the actual sales results, you'll be surprised how many are just under a round number, because people do get really freaked out about jumping it to the next category. But you'll also see some round numbers. Sometimes I've done a quick slam bid, bang, it might only be $5,000, but we were down to $500 bids. And I've just gone, boom, $2 million, and someone's gone, no, she's not going to stop.
Yeah.
So, yeah, having a little bit of powder in the keg is really important.
Thanks, guys. Some really good tips and insights on different selling methods and how to approach expressions of interest in particular when looking to buy a property. Until next week, have a great week, everybody.
Hi there, it's Anne-Marie from Property Planning Australia here. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about some of the topics discussed, take a listen to episodes number 20, Bidding Tactics 101, episode 29, Congenial Negotiation Tactics and How to Apply Them in the Right Situation, episode 85, Off the Market Properties, Everything You Need to Know, episode 94, The Winner's Curse and How to Avoid It, and episode 145, Off the Market Properties, Part 2, How to Tell If the Off Market is Genuine, Identifying a Bad Off Market, How Market Movements Impact the Number and Quality of Off Market Opportunities, and more.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
and the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.